as it are. The general master.
The dining room of Westerheld on 11 August 1981.
So Ward and I went into a lengthy calculation, making a model of the mass distribution, knowing, using all the various data that were then available, and came to the conclusion that, with the exception of a background of about 600 kelvins, which you had to subtract first, it was most remarkable that the mass distribution of the galaxy fitted, if you projected that on the sky, fitted Bolton and Westphal's data with that, with terrific accuracy. And the conclusion, therefore, was that the sources of radio emission quite clearly have the same distribution as all the other matter in the galaxy. It did not, of course, say it was the stars, because, as was mentioned earlier, we all knew that the sun was not a particularly strong radiator. So it was something in among the stars. We also made, again, the calculation by then. One was a little bit further about the distribution of the ionized hydrogen. We made a calculation showing that at 100 megahertz hydrogen, ionized hydrogen certainly would not play any significant role at all in that distribution. Moreover, it was far too narrow, and therefore its distribution was far too narrow. So you could see that. Then, finally, we made a statistical study trying to see if these were point sources, realizing full well that we wouldn't detect individual point sources. What would be the distribution of those? Where, how many would there be? And we came to the conclusion that the nearest one, given a number of different assumptions, always uncertainties, if you put all those uncertainties together, the nearest of the point sources that would cause this radiation would be somewhere between 10 and 100 parsecs, and that would be tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of these around the galaxy. So that was that, and of course it became clear somewhat later when higher resolutions were employed that it's very bad to assume, and what you see with a 17 degree beam is indeed the true picture. Interestingly enough, having made that whole model, we then said, now suppose that the Andromeda Nebula does the same, how much would you expect? So we came up with a number that was about seven times higher than the observations by Hanbury Brown et al. In Jodl Mac. And so a few sentences are spent wondering what's wrong with the Andromeda Nebula. We knew a year later what was wrong with the Andromeda Nebula. We assumed that the Andromeda Nebula was 250 kiloparsecs away, and of course it's considerably farther away. This was before, this was 1950, before the Cepheids population 1 and 2 were discovered, and the scale of the universe suddenly increased by a factor of 2. As a result, our calculations, when you now look back at them, or when you look back at them a year later, said, hey, what Hanbury Brown received was exactly what we expected. Now we start observing. If I can have the next slide. That, of course, is the Würzburg with Müller on the platform. And we use the original house in which which rotated in azimuth with the telescope, and in which we had all the receiving equipment. This telescope, the receiver, the next slide, was assembled in a period of about 5 months, basically from scratch. Remember, previous equipment had all burned down. By the way, when I said there was this big agony of whether to buy a Honeywell ground recorder in the United States, that was also due to the fact that the Philips factories were in the process of developing a Dutch recorder of the same type, but that wasn't going to be ready in time. Anyway, dancing burnt down, and we got a Philips recorder in the end. Anyway, there was in fact even the front end. There was a 1400 megahertz amplifier, but that was never used. That was never put in. We went directly into a crystal mixer, and down to a 13 megahertz. IF, but all the various pieces of equipment were set on a table and connected, and here's a coaxial cable coming out of the antenna, which consisted of a little dipole with a flat plate, flat reflector plate above it. The next slide shows another view of the center, which in this case, that looks like a Honeywell ground recorder. But that was not the one, because the one burned down. A detail of parts of the receiver on the next slide. I don't know whether that means anything to you, it doesn't mean anything to me. Interesting things there was that as one went about building this stuff, one tried to find on the surplus market such things as 6 AK5 low noise tubes for the IF. You found those on the surplus market, you bought as many of them as you could get, and you tested them all, and you picked the best ones out of them. While all this was going on, in February 1949, the first $100,000 for the construction of the 25-meter telescope was allotted to the Foundation for Radio Astronomy for design studies and things like that. Also around that time, I noted in the discussions, before the line was actually discovered, that Van der Hulst was beginning to hedge and made the statement that it was more likely that neutral hydrogen is in molecular form rather than atomic form. It will be very uncertain whether the line will be visible or not. And everybody, several people, such as you and Purcell and the Dutch group were working on it, Van der Hulst said, Jesus, I've been predicting this, I'd better hedge it. So he hedged it. In September 49, the cost of the radio telescope, of the 25-meter telescope, was estimated at 200,000 guilders. And the worry was expressed whether the Americans were perhaps planning to build a big telescope, and would it make sense for us to build one? They had heard and read about Reber's plan to build 214-foot diameter dish on the equator. But then everybody said, well, they probably won't buy any dishes. They have damn good electronics equipment, so we'll build the dish and we'll invite the Americans to Holland with their receivers. Which I think is a reasonable attitude. In 1951, the cost of the 25-meter telescope was estimated at $416,000. By the way, here I have another number. In January of 53, the cost of the telescope was estimated at, guilders. Divide by four and you get dollars in those days. In January 53, it had climbed to 600,000 guilders. But in any case, at that time, the plans were all drawn up and the engineering firm for building the thing. Back to the Kootwijk machinery. We'll have another few slides. Next slide shows some of the very first results. So you see the 4th of June 1951. Was done, but it was a switching receiver which Muller learned from Johan. Van der Hulst was in contact while he was at Harvard with the Dutch, and they corresponded back and forth. So Johan and Muller, sort of without having met each other, knew what each of them was doing. Muller was going to do frequency switching at the second global oscillator level and had terrible trouble, and Johan was doing it at the first global oscillator. So Muller switched the first global oscillator and suddenly got a much more stable system. That's one of the aspects of the collaboration that Frank Kerr talked about earlier. What was done in this particular case, though, was not really a rapid switching. This was a slow switching in that you set at one frequency for a while and then you set at a frequency which you hope was off the line. And this is a drift curve. As you see, this goes from 10, 11, 12, it's about 3.5 hours, 2.5 hours long. And quite clearly, there is a signal here at whatever the frequency was that the receiver was tuned to, that the signal frequency was tuned to. With the aid of drift curves at a number of positions, we got these curves. We noted, for example, that when you cross the Milky Way in the neighborhood of the galactic center, you got a very broad distribution, distribution that was something like 20 degrees wide. In fact, most of the distributions were sort of 10 to 20 degrees wide. And the conclusion there was that what we are seeing is nearby stuff, nearby clouds. Because everybody knows that the galactic center region must be considerably narrower in distribution. So that was one of the conclusions from that first month's worth of data. The next slide shows what then happens. This is sort of the first line profile, first week or so, when one actually tuned the second local oscillator through the profile. The two switching frequencies were 160 kilohertz apart, and therefore these two peaks are 160 kilohertz apart. Later on, one found out, as Frank also remarked, that the profiles are very much wider, so 160 kilohertz was moved out to 600 kilohertz and later to 1.5 megahertz. But this was simply going through the peak with the signal frequency and then going through the peak with the reference frequency. Later on, the situation became somewhat different. The equipment, after those first months of data, Muller went back and started building up the receiver properly, and Oort and Van der Hulst and everybody else had to sit around for about a year waiting for the equipment to really be working well. And that was in the summer of 52, when a big survey started for a year, 52 to 53, and here again, one tuned the receiver with a little motor on the, I forget what the big canister oscillator called. What was this called again?
The cabin.
The cabin, no, but it had a name.
The light has
a name. There was an oscillator cavity, anyway. There was a little motor, it was a little rubber band, a turn band, and you read it every now and again. You press the button and that gave those lines, dial indicators on the oscillator, and that had then to be calibrated in frequency and then in turn into radio velocity. Obviously, you also noticed that frequencies weren't far enough apart. This profile should end about here, so they overlapped. So what had to be done was they all had to be read. Then something had to be added to this piece, something had to be added to that piece after it was inverted, and then finally the whole thing had to be put in terms of velocity. That was all done in a period of 3 weeks in the summer of 1953, when Oort decided now we've got enough data to publish. In fact, the number of profiles available was approximately 40. And all the graduate students in Leiden were herded into the lecture room, which was, because it was summer, wasn't used. There were a number of big tables, and we were all sitting at the big tables, and everybody was given a task. One of them was doing nothing but reading the heights with a little ruler. Another one was very carefully drawing zero lines, somehow or another making sure that this height was equal to that height. A certain one was applying corrections for the fact that this width is of course partly due to the random velocity of the clouds, and you have to correct it. So that was corrected down so that the gaps in between the spiral arms went all the way down to zero. So there were about 10 people there sitting there calculating day in, day out, and in a month the whole thing was finished, and Oort, Van der Hulst and Muller wrote the article which appeared then in the BAN in 1954, giving the story of the spiral structure, saying, by the way, we looked at some other things too. For example, we looked at the Taurus dark clouds, and we find that the brightest temperature of the Taurus dark cloud actually goes down rather than up. That must indicate that presumably either the temperature, because of the fact that there was such a lot of dust, is going down, the gas temperature has gone down, or else it might mean that a lot of the hydrogen in the dense clouds is in molecular form. The next slide shows the line profiles that were used for that early article. profile about every 5 degrees all the way from the galactic center is at 327. So about 5 degrees south of the galactic center, all the way to the horizon on the other side, through the galactic anticenter, which was a longitude of about 150. These are, of course, old galactic longitudes. The next slide shows the receiver as it then was developed in 1953. And from November 53 to August 55, we started into a big survey covering the entire Milky Way at 2.5 degree intervals from plus 10 to minus 10 degrees latitude, and that finally resulted in the maps of the galaxy that we're all familiar with that are still used in the textbooks of today. The next slide shows the improved version. Now this is after a while in the Kodrak dish, Muller learned to shape the reflector plate over the dipole. So the reflector plate over the dipole was shaped. Then when in 55 the whole kit and caboodle was moved to Dwingeloo, he simply took that reflector plate and built the IF section right behind the reflector plate, saying, I have experimented with that reflector plate, let's hang on to that same reflector plate. And that turned out to be a wise result when later on it was tested that. And he performed a very good function there. The next slide shows the line profiles as they then came out from 53 to 55, where there was a little 10 kilohertz oscillator that gave beats with the local oscillator and therefore gave a nice short circuit in the recorder every 10 kilohertz. Moreover, every 100 kilohertz, there was another thing that made a beat, and that beat could be listened to on a speaker. So every 100 kilohertz, the thing went and the thing went down, and you had to go to the recorder and put a little cross on there. Also, it should be noted that that Wurzburg antenna had motors for fast motion, but for slow motion, in order to follow something, you had to crank a little crank on the floor here in azimuth and a little crank in the wall for elevation. There was a little hole in the floor where you could read the azimuth circle, which had about this. Bigger diameter than the size of the board, and through a little hole in the wall you could read the elevation circle. And there were tables for every longitude that was to be observed, giving the azimuth and elevation as a function of sidereal time. And you read those tables, and graduate students were used to crank the hand cranks for 2.5 years to work that telescope, which was extremely interesting exercise, I can assure you. The next slide, I'm almost through, Woody. Next one, please. Next slide. Next one. Go on. I want to show you one or two slides of Dwingeloo. This one, the next one, and relate one other, next slide, one other thing that people perhaps don't quite remember. This telescope was dedicated in April of 1956, and at that point we got the first 21 centimeter line radiation with the central mass. This at that time did not have a tripod, but the receiver was all sitting at the top there in that tiny little box. But in November of 1955, there were two occultations of the Grand Nebula by the Moon, and it was years before that was going to happen again in the area of the Netherlands. At that time, there had been some extensive investigations of the polarization of the Grand Nebula in optical light, and it was considered so important to observe the precise distribution of the radio waves in the Grand Nebula that we got the contractor to stop all construction for a period of 3 days in the beginning of November, and for the second occultation for a period of 3 days at the end of November. The first period, the telescope could not move in elevation, so the contractor, and the occultation was at 7 degrees elevation, so the contractor made a boom that stuck out from here to there, which held the telescope in place at an elevation of 7 degrees. And the way in which we followed the Grand Nebula as it rose was by lowering that boom slowly, with the aid of a little of a hand crank and a cable, and on the cable was a little piece of string with a little pointer, which was calibrated in minutes of arc, and by turning it in azimuth with a little hand crank in the azimuth gearbox and an alarm clock which I had bought in a nearby grocery store to somehow or another give you some measure for azimuth. And both those occultation observations worked extremely well. The contractor then went back and finished the telescope so that the Queen could press the button in April of 1956. That would make the telescope move. Well, the telescope didn't move because everybody got so nervous that inside the telescope, everybody started pressing the wrong buttons and nothing happened. So several people could be seen sprinting into the telescope, which was supposed to have been started automatically with the Queen pressing that red button. Instead, after a whole night's work, that red button was attached to a little lamp that went on inside the telescope. And there were two of the technicians ready to press buttons, but they pressed all the wrong buttons. That's right, there is another one there, and that is that the temperature calibration, which turns out to be still within 5% to what we're using today, was arrived at by pointing the dish down into the pine forest and measuring the increase in temperature between that and the zenith. That increase in temperature was, of course, supposed to be 290 kelvins or whatever the local temperature was, and that provided the calibration of the temperature scale of the 21 centimeter line.
Chris.
I'd just like to comment that it's very interesting for people that realize nowadays the entire difference between that group and everyone else. You can still see it very well from Gatt's talk that was a professional astronomical group, but it was a bunch of engineers.
I don't think you have to say such a derogatory story matter, but
Al.
I didn't hear clearly whether you said that you made a little error in the star rod and then you concluded that you couldn't see recombination lines at radio frequencies. So we left the Carter shop nearly 20 years later to do the correct calculation and predict that one could see them, and they were, of course, an accurate discovery.
The way I read it, and we can fight that out together because I have the article here, the weird way I read it was that he wasn't really sure of the star broadening. So therefore, for the moment, the 21 centimeter line looked more promising.
I can talk about that also, but we don't have time right now. Brian?
I was just going to say, to illustrate the difference between astronomers and engineers, Chris pointed out, Westerhout put an optical telescope on William O. Check. Pointing and drove off to America, but he had measured the tracking of the telescope and it was good to two little things beside it, one second to that. But they were read by the Americans to find the T-shirts and put it down. It wasn't particularly good.
Could you show the very last slide that put in? No. A whole lot further. Just turn the thing.
It must be pretty close to it.
Yeah.
Right there. Don't go to the very last one, remember.
No. Down, one further back.
One back.
Who is it?
That's one. That's the was the next stage. That started the discussion on that started in 1957 after we got the first results from Twinkleo, saying now we have 30 minutes of arc. We now need 1 minute of arc resolution. And that was one of the first designs for the Benelux cross antenna, which to show the astronomer rather than the engineer, the astronomer had to see how big it was. So I made a model of it on the top of the city of Leiden so that people could really see how big it was.
The same technique is used for the VLA relative to the city of Washington, D.C. in recent years, and many of you know, a great one for the congressman. Well, I think we better close the session, but do not forget that in 5 minutes, we'll start a videotape on these monitors of an Australian Broadcasting Commission film on Grote Reber, his radio astronomy, his philosophy of life, and the last third of the film gets into other things that he's done, such as dating of Aboriginal sites, cosmic ray research, electric cars. But the first 30 minutes is primarily on radio astronomy, also has some of John Bolton, and I think many of you will find it interesting. But we'll start that in 5 minutes. And before we go, if we can see that last slide, I've been showing these old slides of the other people. I play a joke on myself. This is the very last one. This is myself in 1949 when John Bolton was making the first identifications of radio sources.
Okay, that's the end of the recording of the entire 3.5 hour session on the history of radio astronomy at the 20th IRC General Assembly in Washington, D.C. on 11 August 1981.